What I'm going to try and give you here is a talk that tries to connect up these three words in the title, and there's maybe a surprising relation between these. I'm trying to suggest why thinking about Shakespeare is helpful in thinking about questions of politics and territory today. So the opening picture that I've got up here is a scene from a fairly recent film version of King Lear, and the person sitting at the table is the character playing King Lear in that, it's Ian McKellen. Many of you will know him as Gandalf from The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, or as Magneto in the X-Men movies. And what's happening in this scene, it's the opening scene of the play, and the king is talking to the three women who are his daughters, Regan, Goneril, and Cordelia. What does he say to his three daughters there? He's looking at a map on a table, he's talking to his three daughters. This is the opening scene of the play. It's setting up everything that's going to happen later on in the play. Meanwhile, he says, "We shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map there. Know we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we unburdened crawl towards death." He thinks he's getting old. He thinks he's going to die fairly soon. He's thinking about this question of succession. Who's going to take over the kingdom that he has built up and preserved over his lifetime? He wants to divide it into three. He has three daughters. You can understand what he might be thinking here. "As son of Cornwall and you, our no less loving son of Albany, we have this hour a constant will to publish our daughters' several dowers, that future strife may be prevented now. The princes France and Burgundy, great rivals in our youngest daughter's love, long in our court have made their amorous sojourn, and here are to be answered." So what he's talking about here is not the daughters, but who they're married to. So his two eldest daughters are married to the Duke of Albany and to the Duke of Cornwall, two very powerful landowners within the kingdom that Lear has established. His youngest daughter, Cordelia, hasn't yet got married, but two people want to marry her, the Duke of Burgundy and the King of France. So he's saying that these two people, the rivals in his youngest daughter's affections, are in the court. They're waiting to find out who's going to marry the daughter and possibly to find out what dowry is going to come with it. The dowry, a gift of land or a gift of money that is given at the moment of marriage. So he's got two older daughters already married and a younger daughter who's about to be married. "Tell me, my daughters," and this is where he starts to test them. "Tell me, my daughters, since now we shall divest us both of rule, interest of territory, cares of state, which of you shall say we doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge?" He's going to test his three daughters. He wants them to tell him how much they love him, and the one that gives him the biggest kind of praise and says how wonderful he is and how much she loves him above anyone else and so on, they're likely to get the best share of the kingdom that's being divided into three. So his idea is that he's already made a division of the kingdom. He said this at the top, and he certainly, as he goes on, he'll give a share of the land to each daughter in turn, rather than waiting for all three to say how much they love him. So it's not really a test, but it's a way of trying to work out what the relation his daughters have to him, and to put these powerful landowners, the Duke of Albany, the Duke of Cornwall, the King of France, or the Duke of Burgundy, to put them in relation to the succession of his kingdom and to preserve it going on into the future. And so it's a question, in a sense, of the division of England, Scotland, and parts of Wales, and the division of this between the succession, the next generation, following after Lear. So it's already a sense of a kind of a political question, who rules, but also a geographical question, where do they rule? The territory of England. So in that passage there at the end, when he says, "We want to divest us both of rule, a political question, interest of territory, a geographical question, cares of state, a political geographical question." So it's the intertwining of those relations that he's thinking about here and where they go from that point onwards. Second example from Shakespeare that thinks about these kinds of questions. This is a still from a recent film version of Hamlet, and the character there, Patrick Stewart, is playing the character. You'll probably know Patrick Stewart either from Star Trek or again from the X-Men movies. So he appears as a ghost at the beginning of the play. This is the ghost of the dead king. King called Hamlet, his son is also called Hamlet. I'll try and distinguish between the two as I go on with this. But this is the ghost of the dead king. And the military men keeping watch on the city battlements say this: "What art thou, looking at the ghost, that usurps this time of night, together with that fair and warlike form in which the majesty of Berry Denmark did sometimes march?" They're saying he looks just like the dead king. Denmark here means the king of Denmark rather than just the country of Denmark. So it's saying, in physical resemblance, it looks just like the king. A few lines later, such was the very armour he had on when he, the ambitious Norway, combated. So frowned he once when in an angry parle he smote the sledded Polacks on the ice. What do those lines mean? Well, in the first couple of lines, it's quite straightforward. He's saying that he's wearing this ghostly figure that has appeared. He's wearing the very armour that he had when he was fighting Norway. Not just the country of Norway, but the king of Norway. His name was Fortinbras. He was fighting him and he was wearing the very same armour that now this ghostly apparition appears to them in. Then two very ambiguous lines. So frowned he once when in an angry parle he smote the sledded Polacks on the ice. Well, he's talking about this as an angry parle, a disagreement, some kind of fight or a contest again. And he frowned in that particular expression. That's something that they resemble, that they recognise too. But what does it mean to say he smote the sledded Polacks on the ice? Well, successions of people editing Shakespeare's texts have tried to change that one word, Polacks, because they don't know what it means. You find in the fourth folio edition of Shakespeare's writings, from the middle of the 17th century, that they amended it to say a pole axe. A pole axe is a kind of weapon. It's an axe at the end of a pole. It looks something like this. And a sledded pole axe is a kind of like a sledgehammer. It's a heavily weighted counterbalance to the axe on one side, so that you have a pole, a sharp point, an axe blade, and the sledded part is a kind of hammer-type thing on the other side of the weapon. That kind of makes some sense. You can imagine that he was in an argument, he had this weapon, and he smashed it down onto the ice in part of this disagreement that was going on at that time. But there are different editions of Shakespeare's texts, even from within Shakespeare's own lifetime and a few years after his death, that have slightly different versions of words. Sometimes these are introduced because printers didn't print them properly, because they were lazy or drunk or whatever other reason there might have been for why they didn't put these texts together properly, or people misheard things or they misread things that were written in a manuscript. So there are differences between Shakespeare's plays, and Hamlet is one of the ones where there's biggest differences. But what does it say in the quarto edition of the text, one that was published in Shakespeare's own lifetime? The first couple of lines, description of this ghost, very, very similar, most of the same point being made in that point. And when you get to this part, there's another slight amended version in there, a different spelling of the word sledded, which is probably leaded or some kind of sledgehammer type element that they're suggesting here. Now, they amend this in most critical editions of this to say something different, the sledded Polacks. Now, Polacks is today a derogatory word for Polish people. In Shakespeare's time, it didn't have that negative connotation, but it was a word that effectively meant the same as Poles or Polish. So what does it mean when he's saying he smote the sledded Polacks on the ice? Well, it could be Polish soldiers on sledges on the ice, and that Hamlet, the king, disagreed with them and fought with them in this point. So there's an argument there that you might read those two lines, those two pairs of lines in that second part, one of them as a combat with Norway and the other as a combat with Poland. So Denmark as a country, powerful neighbours to the north in Norway, powerful neighbours to the east in Poland. So it might be creating a kind of more political, geographical, or what we might call geopolitical context to the battles that the earlier king had fought to preserve his kingdom. Or perhaps slightly more than that. This is a long passage. I'll read it all through, and then I'll go back and explain what I think it means in this. They're talking again about the heritage of the last King Hamlet, the father of the title character of the play. So they say, our last king, whose image even now but appeared to us, was, as you know, by Fortinbras of Norway, thereto pricked on by a most emulate pride, dared to the combat in which our valiant Hamlet, for though this side of our known world esteemed him, did slay this Fortinbras, who by a sealed compact, well ratified by law and heraldry, did forfeit with his life all these his lands, which he stood seized of to the conqueror, against the which a moiety competent was gauged by our king, which had returned to the inheritance of Fortinbras, had he been vanquisher, as by the same co-martin carriage of the article design, his fell to Hamlet. Now, sir, young Fortinbras, this is the son, of unimproved metal hot and full, hath in the skirts of Norway here and there sharked up a list of lawless resolutes for food and diet to some enterprise that hath a stomach in it, which is no other, as it doth well appear unto the state, but to recover of us by strong hand and terms compulsatory those foresaid lands, so by his father lost. And this, I take it, is the main motive of our preparations, the source of this our watch, and the chief head of this post-haste and rummage in the land. Very complicated passage, a quite short passage, but compressing an awful lot of history that Shakespeare is telling us through the mouth of his character Horatio to explain what has happened in the historical past so that we can understand what's happening in the present, the moment where the play is set. What sorts of things are being suggested in this? Well, the first one is that there's this confusion between names. King Hamlet has a son also called Hamlet. King Fortinbras has a son also called Fortinbras. It's confusing, but the point is that these two people are both the inheritors of the name, and they hope to be the inheritors of the land that their fathers had claimed and gained through warfare or through conquest beforehand. So, the two fathers, Hamlet and Fortinbras, one of Denmark, one of Norway, had got into this argument. And in that argument that had turned into a kind of a duel between them, they both bet land, they put a wager of land against the other. Whoever won in that would gain the land from the other person. As it happened, Hamlet was the person who won, and so gained some land from Norway. And the suggestion is, this is the land that the court of Elsinore, where the action of Hamlet is actually sitting. So there's a gain of land, a gain of territory, we might say, through this combat a whole generation ago between these two fathers. Had it been the other way round, had Fortinbras defeated Hamlet, well, then Hamlet would have lost those lands and that they would have gone towards Norway. So there's a historical moment that explains how they've got to the territory that they have at the present. Now, young Fortinbras doesn't want to accept this state of affairs. And so the argument is that in the skirts of Norway, the outskirts of Norway, or the border regions of Norway, he sharked up a list of lawless resolutes. A variant of the text has landless resolutes, people that don't have land themselves. And he's stirring up this army to go against Denmark to reclaim the lands that his father lost through that battle. And the suggestion is, towards the end of it, it's because Norway is a threatening power towards Denmark again, as it had been at some point in the past, because it's a threat again, this is why Horatio and his colleagues are standing on the battlements at night, keeping a watch, trying to make sure that nothing's going to come and attack the country, attack the court of Elsinore. So it's a suggestion in the historical past of how they got to the kind of political, geographical, territorial arrangement of how they're thinking about things in the present time. Why does this matter today? Well, what it's giving, in a sense, is a background to how some of the states that Shakespeare talks about in his plays came to have the shape that they had. Why their borders are here and not there, why these lands are grouped together, why these lands are separated. If you look at a physical geography map of the world, how did we get from that to a political geographical map of the world? Why are the borders between states in the places that they are? Why are territories located in the way that we are? Where did this idea that we should divide the world up into states that have clearly marked out territories on this map, coloured in different colours so that you can distinguish between them? So how did we get from this to this? Well, in a sense, that's the question of political geography. It's the question of territory. It's the question of thinking about the relation between where we are and the political rule that we're subject to. Why is it when we cross an international boundary that we're subject to an entirely different set of laws? Why is it if you're on one side of a boundary and you're trying to get to another side that the states on both sides have a say about whether you're able to move? Questions of migration, immigration, and so on. These kinds of questions are geographical questions as much as they're political questions. So why does territory matter today? There's a whole range of examples. I'm just going to throw out a few here to try and link up some things that you'll be aware of through your studies, through things you've seen in the news, and so on, about why politics and geography or politics and territory are important together. A whole range of questions were thrown up by the War on Terror. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, about what a state was able to do within its territory and what other states outside that territory were able to do to those states, whether international boundaries were sacrosanct, whether sovereignty was a right that every state had, and so on. There's a whole range of issues happening because of climate change, particularly if you look at Canada. Canada had always seen the northern parts of Canada, the frozen areas up into the Arctic, as its own land, that it was claiming this as much as it was claiming solid land in the southern parts of Canada. But as climate change is changing ocean currents, changing ice, changing where these things might become passages that ships can sail through, Canada's having to start to deal with a whole range of complications around these kinds of questions. So Canada is a whole set of territorial issues that it didn't really worry about before, but are being forced on it by some physical geographical changes. African states, if you look at Libya, the intervention to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi, does Libya still make sense as a single state, or is Libya going to break up into different states within the former territory of Libya? How did Libya get its shape as a state in the first place? Why are those lines in the way that they are? Why does it have those straight line boundaries in the south going down into the to the desert? What's happening in Nigeria at the moment? There's a group in northern Nigeria called Boko Haram, which are effectively fighting a civil war against the federal government of Nigeria. But why are those people within the same state as a lot of other people who they don't necessarily feel a particular affinity towards? There's colonial historical reasons for that. Or the intervention that happened in the last couple of years where France sent troops into Mali, again because there was an Islamic group in the north and France went to support the government of Mali and that they sent forces into the north to try to prevent that state from breaking in two. Or the very, very charged question of political and geographical questions in Israel and Palestine. Or going a little bit further back, after the end of the Cold War, the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. So a whole range of territorial and political questions today, and the suggestion is how we can think about those, not just in the present moment, but also with a historical perspective. Another example would be to look at this map of Kurdistan. Kurdistan is a very frequently mentioned place as somewhere that people say, well, it doesn't exist as a state yet, but there are a clearly identifiable people understood to be Kurdish who should have their own state. The problem with the Kurdish people for redrawing the boundaries there is where are the Kurdish people? And they tend to be in a number of different states, depending on different ways people have understood this. There are people within the borders of modern Turkey, within modern Syria, Iran, and Iraq. How then would you think about drawing the boundaries of a new Kurdistan if you were to create a new state? Well, this is a composite map of all of the different plans for drawing the boundaries of Kurdistan. You can see those different colour thick border lines that have been drawn crossing over the white lines that are of existing states' boundaries. And you can see the complications of how different people at different times have thought about what the territory of a future Kurdistan might actually be. Or you get examples where people try to redraw the boundaries of states. These are kind of people sitting in armchairs, often in North America or Western Europe, thinking that if only we could have the boundaries in the right places, we could get rid of all of the problems that are going on within world politics today. So you get people, this is an American plan, of taking the boundaries of the Middle East, the Saudi Peninsula, and through into the Indian subcontinent, and saying if we just put these boundaries in different places, we could resolve some of these issues. So they move from this to this. You see some new states emerging, such as Baluchistan. The states in red have lost territory. There's been a redivide of how territories might be within the Saudi Peninsula, and the argument is going that these are more fitting to how people actually live in terms of the physical landscape, rather than simply the ways that those boundaries were drawn in the past. What's important to recognise is that most of these borders were drawn by the British or the French or other colonial powers in the historical past. These were not necessarily borders that were chosen by the people in those areas themselves, but they were borders that were drawn through precisely these same kind of exercises. So something like this might look arbitrary in terms of how you shift from this to this, but even this is an arbitrary division that the French and the British and others made at some point in the historical past. Or a recent thing, this comes from the New York Times, where saying that some of the things that are happening in Syria at the moment with the civil war that's going on, or the legacy of the intervention within Libya, getting rid of Colonel Gaddafi from power, that this might lead to a redrawing of some of these boundaries. So this is the most recent example I've found of somebody suggesting that they could sit there and they could work out exactly where those borders should be, where territory should be located, so that you could try and resolve some of those issues. Now, I've written about this. One of the things that's going to happen at universities, you'll be taught by people who are actually doing research and writing about the types of topics that they're teaching you about. And so when I teach a lot of courses on territory and politics and these kinds of questions, I've also written books about the questions of territory. And this is a book I wrote a few years ago, which was to try to understand what was happening in the War on Terror around the question of territory, how this might be changing the way that we think about territory, and particularly the relation between political power, sometimes understood as sovereignty, and that territory. I'm not going to say very much about this, but this is a a kind of a very political book about the kind of questions I'm now exploring in a slightly different way. And one of the things that I focus on in that book is a very famous quotation from a German sociologist, Max Weber, where he's defining the state. Now, the state is obviously a political question. If you think about the relations between states, that's a kind of international political question. But what I'm interested in is that Weber picks on the geographical aspect of this, and I think that's particularly important to the kind of questions that I'm interested in thinking about. And Weber's talking about the state, and he's defining it through four different elements. It's a human community, it's a group of people. It's defined by the particular location that it's in, a territory or an area or a region. It's got some kind of monopoly of power, what he calls physical violence, but it's to do with only a state has law, only a state has an armed forces, a military, only a state has a police force. So the state has a particular type of power. And then he talks about how that power is made legitimate. I'm not going to go into that in detail. But I kept coming back to this Weber quotation because it seemed to me to be, on the one hand, such a straightforward definition. The state is that human community which, within a certain territory, has a successful monopoly of legitimate physical violence. But what I became interested in is, where did this idea come from? Have we always thought in this way? Or does this idea have a history to it? And so I ended up writing a book that talked about the historical aspects of the question of territory to try to understand why we came up with this idea that if we look at the Earth's surface, we can draw boundaries, we can separate out and include within these different territories, and that almost every portion of the Earth's surface gets divided into territories on this idea. This isn't actually that old an idea. In Western Europe, it's only as old as the 17th century, and in other parts of the world, it's a bit more recent thing than that. So I wrote a very historical book, a fairly quite dull and historical book, to think about those kinds of questions. Now, what I try and suggest in that work, and this is where I'm going to come back to Shakespeare to pull this together, because this is what I'm now thinking about and working on, is to suggest that territory is actually a much more complicated concept than people generally think it is. It's obviously a political concept. It's obviously something that has political resonances. You have a prime minister of this country, and this country's laws apply only within the boundaries of the United Kingdom as a territory. If you cross over those boundaries, if you go over to France, for example, a different political regime applies in those areas. So it's a political question. It's obviously a geographical question. Where are those boundaries in terms of the physical landscape? But I think it's more complicated than that. There's economic questions around territory. Territory is, in some sense, a bit like land. If you think about a farmer who owns the lands in a particular area, a territory is not that dissimilar to just taking those lands and adding more and more lands and accumulating them, becoming a much larger area that's ruled over. So there's relations of property and the question of land, economic questions. There's also strategic questions. Think about physical terrain. Think about warfare. If you have tanks and you want to move tanks across a physical landscape, well, those tanks have got to be able to be supported by the landscape that you're going over. If you're fighting in a desert, this might be a big issue. If you're trying to go through a forest, you may not be able to maneuver them through this area. So questions of the physical landscape become important, and also kind of power struggles of how armies might fight over territories in order to gain land, or they might lose land through those kinds of battles. There's also the legal questions, and I've hinted at these before, about where do laws apply and where do laws stop applying. And there are technical questions. How does cartography matter? How does land surveying matter? How does statistics matter? Statistics originally meant a description of a state. It was to do with states trying to understand who their population was, where they were located, their birth rates, their death rates, these kind of questions. But these also fold into the way we think about the question of territory. Now, Shakespeare is often read politically. I mean, I gave you a kind of quick version of that through King Lear and Hamlet right at the beginning. But Shakespeare is often read politically. And if you're working on Shakespeare, even within a kind of an English studies background, you're probably thinking about political questions. Just a couple of examples. Coriolanus, some of you may have seen the recent Ralph Fiennes film of Coriolanus, which reimagines this set in a kind of present-day Balkans. Clash between the common people and the political rulers in that place. Macbeth, many of you will know, I guess, Macbeth. Macbeth kills the king, becomes the king in his place, but has to keep killing people because he's never able to make his rule seen as legitimate, accepted by other people. So there's political questions in Macbeth And Richard II of Shakespeare's history plays explores very similar questions of killing to take a position and then the struggle to try to preserve this. And other examples, I won't go into all of these, but we maybe talk about some of them in question. So why Shakespeare then, if he's read politically, what about the question of territory? Well, one thing that's interesting in Shakespeare is that the word territory appears only twice. I gave you one of the examples in King Lear. It also appears in the play As You Like It. The word territories, a kind of plural, appears in a few more instances, but it's still a relatively rare word within Shakespeare. But equally, there's a whole range of things going on in Shakespeare that seem to me to actually relate very closely to the questions of territory that I've been trying to work on over the past several years. Because there's a number of issues in Shakespeare about exile, sending people outside of the boundaries of the territory, of conquering territories, of dividing territories. You saw that in terms of the King Lear passage that I gave you right at the beginning. A whole set of these questions that appear in Shakespeare that maybe means that Shakespeare is interesting to think about territory. And if you take those different aspects of territory that I suggested were important and were not always understood when people thought about territory, what I'm trying to do at the moment is to use different plays of Shakespeare to open up those different aspects of the question of territory. So the economic, the property and land argument, I think you can do through King Lear, both in terms of the plot of Lear dividing up the kingdom between his daughters and their husbands, but also in terms of a subplot in that play where the Duke of Gloucester has two sons, one of whom is legitimate and the other one is a bastard son. And the question is, who is able to inherit his land? That's another aspect within Lear. It's also there in some of the history plays, particularly Richard II. There's a lot of warfare in Shakespeare, of strategic questions of conquest of territory, of fighting over contested lands and so on. You can see that in Macbeth and in the Hamlet example I gave you a few moments ago. There are legal questions in Shakespeare, particularly in Henry V. There are technical things, administration is a kind of political technology or a political tool of governance, of measuring, of counting, of mapping, of surveying. These come up in a number of Shakespeare plays. And then there are other aspects. So in Coriolanus, there's a lot of talk about bodies, bodies of people, bodies of animals, wounds, but also the body of the state, the kind of the idea that a state is like an organic thing that has a body. You also get colonial questions coming up in Shakespeare. The Tempest is the famous play that examines those questions, but there's also a whole range of colonial questions, I think, in some of Shakespeare's other plays. Antony and Cleopatra and Pericles historically, but also Othello. Othello, which some of you may be studying, Othello is a play where Othello is actually the person... Are people studying Othello?
Yeah.
Okay. So in Othello, why is Othello the politically powerful person that he is? Othello is partly that because he's been successful in warfare. But what is Othello's main task in the play? It's to become the governor of Cyprus. So from Venice, part of modern-day Italy, he's going far into the eastern Mediterranean to be the governor of a colonial possession of Venice. And that much of the interest within that play, much of the action within that play, takes place in that colonial overseas possession of Venice. There's also questions of what lies outside of territory. Today, it's very, very difficult for us to imagine that. If we cross over one boundary, we enter into a territory of another place. In Shakespeare's time, it wasn't quite so straightforward. There was a lot of the world that hadn't yet been colonised by Europeans, where the people would claim that this wasn't yet a territory of somewhere, but it was unclaimed land that might be able to be possessed. If you go back historically, and a lot of Shakespeare's plays are set in a historical past, you might have a human settlement and another human settlement, but an awful lot of nothingness or wilderness between them. So there's various plays where the idea of the wild or the outside of territory comes up in Shakespeare's plays. I'm trying to think about those kinds of questions at the moment. So this is why it seems to me that thinking about Shakespeare and territory is interesting, because it offers for me a different way of thinking about questions I've been exploring in other work, in very political writing, in very historical writing. But it maybe opens up some of these complexities around the question of territory, and I'm hoping it does so in a kind of more interesting way than some of the historical work that I've done before.